Hi, my name is Johnny Gartner, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Cedar 60 Podcast. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel, and today we are excited to have Dr. Bert Wheeler on the podcast to discuss capitalism and Christianity. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Johnny. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time. We really want to use the vast resource of Cedarville professors and their vast knowledge of their topics to kind of address how Christians can engage reasonably and responsibly in politics and culture in general. I think one of the kind of the foundations of at least the past American conception of economics, which is what you focus on, is capitalism. So we'll definitely address that. But if you could just start with kind of an introduction of, you know, your studies and, you know, kind of your past and what led you to Cedarville, that'd be great.
Yeah, thanks. I went through a radical conversion to Christianity when I was 20, 21 years of age. I was already studying economics at the time and just really didn't know what I should do. So I was an undergraduate at that time. Okay. Between my sophomore and junior year, I believe, is okay. I think it's when it occurred. I know it was in a summer. And I just continued with economics because I didn't really know anything beyond that. Went into grad school.
Okay.
I mean, just kept going. I had finished my comprehensive exams, and at that time, then I felt God was calling me into full-time service. For me, that was a call to preach, so I wanted to go to seminary. I dropped in on my department chair, William Cole, and said, "Dr. Cole, I have received the call to preach." And he said, "Well, Bert, I'm glad that God has your telephone number, but you have to at least tell me you're finishing your dissertation, or I will cut off all of your, you know, all the financial support you're getting right now." And after about 3 seconds of reflection, I said, "Well, Dr. Cole, let's do this dissertation." So I did a dissertation quickly. And I think maybe in less than a year, I had the whole thing rolled up and gone. Went to seminary thinking that I would never do much with economics. I looked upon it as old worldly fables and just a very heathen way of looking at the world, which it really is. It is a secular enlightenment discipline to the core. When I arrived at seminary, I only made it about halfway through the degree. And coming from a PhD, seminary was not exactly on the same level. It was learning a bunch of material, but it was memorizing what other people thought, at least where I went to seminary. And it just didn't really light my fire quite as much as I would have thought. So I dropped out of seminary, although my resume says further study, but I dropped out and worked for 1 year at a Christian college and became very much interested in Christian perspectives on economics.
Okay.
Worked for 4 years at Liberty University, left Liberty in 1992 to come to Cedarville.
Okay. And
so my background has very much influenced the way I look at things. I wouldn't be teaching economics if I wasn't very interested in a Christian and a moral ethical foundation.
So if you could kind of talk about, you know, from your Christian perspective, kind of what economics has meant traditionally towards kind of the modern understanding of economics. And I know that's a really broad thing to address in just a couple minutes, but if you could give it a whirl, we'd appreciate it.
Well, of course, we've had economics as long as we've had people. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. This side of the fall, with the curse upon the world, we have what economists talk about as scarcity. And you couple that with our innate inability to find satisfaction, and you put those two things together, and that's really what economics deals with. But it wasn't until the publication in 1776 of The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith that really we see the birthplace of modern economics. Now, church people had talked about economics, and you know, it has come up, but really modern econ stems from Adam Smith. And there's a lot that Smith says that is still correct today. And in some ways, we've never gone beyond what Smith said. There's always been a religious overtone to economics just because of the discipline. So if you look at, for instance, economics in the United States, took a big move forward with the establishment of the American Economic Association, late 1800s, early 1900s, and the men that established that association were believers. Now, they were not conservative evangelical believers. Some of them were much more in favor of a social gospel, but they were very religious and were believers. So that element has been with economics always.
Yeah. You talked about Adam Smith, pretty foundational person in the understanding of economics. So if you could briefly explain what his basic argument was in The Wealth of Nations, and then kind of talk about how that has led to our modern conception of this term called capitalism and what that means.
Yeah. Smith was a political philosopher. And The Wealth of Nations is long. He wrote two major books, Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was kind of foundational to The Wealth of Nations, but published more than a decade before The Wealth of Nations. So I would say if you had to distill The Wealth of Nations into a bumper sticker, it has to do with increasing productivity that comes from division of labor, specialization, and expanding the market. And a lot of economics is about trade. Mm. People simply trade. That is one thing that is endemic to all of humanity. When people have things, they trade what other people have. And what Smith helped us to do was to understand ways that we could organize culture and society to produce more so we could trade more.
If you could quickly talk about this idea of productivity, because that's also kind of fundamental. It's the idea that, you know, I work a certain number of hours, I get paid, and, you know, dollar bill is not a representation of how much a piece of paper is worth, but it's a representation of my labor that went into that, you know, productivity to create that money. So if you could talk about how that's kind of established wealth as it relates to capitalism, and kind of talk about the foundation of capitalism in America.
Well, if I think what you're hinting at is what is a just payment and a receipt, you know, for my day's labor. One big thing that Adam Smith didn't get is he ascribed to what we call a labor theory of value, and that says that the value of our product, of the things that we're doing, is inherent completely and wholly and resident in the individual person created in the image of God. And one of the things that we discovered a little bit later on is that it's not just that supply side, but it's also the demand for what you're producing. So when you talk about the wage that you should be receiving, in theory, I can tell you pretty much what it is. It has to do with how much you produce, but then it's what that production itself is worth. What value is it when it's sold on the open market? And so technically, we call that marginal revenue product, but I mean, it just means that I'm doing something here at Cedarville, and Cedarville is selling it, you know, to the students. You guys pay something. So, how much, in theory, you know, does what Dr. Wheeler does add to the value of the education? And that's what I should be, you know, should be paid. In practice, of course, it's almost impossible to know what that is. And that's why we see a lot of the tension. You know, human beings always think they're worth more and they should, they want more. I'm worth more. I'm getting cheated. And then on the other side, the employers, by and large, don't want to pay more than they have to for their workers. And so, you end up with this ongoing tension that will never, you know, it'll never really be resolved.
Yeah, you talk about the market that you talk about, and free market capitalism is kind of, you know, the conservative, at least traditionally in America, but also
maybe it used to be.
Maybe it used to be, yes. Yeah. So it used to be the approach to how we understood economic policy. So if you could, you know, you kind of hinted at it's changed. So kind of say how it started out and where it's come to today, and kind of how the economic outlook is looking according to capitalist standards as in America.
On net, of course, the economic outlook is continuing to be very bright in the longer term.
Right.
And so I don't think we're really going to turn away from what we call a capitalist way of organizing culture and society. You can almost always follow the money. And when you move away from capitalism, you tend to produce less. And when you produce less, you have less wealth. And people don't like that. So when we can argue about it around the edges. Contemporary socialists in the United States are not really socialists in any meaningful sense of the term. You know, socialism has to do with technically who owns the resources. If they're government-owned, then we call that socialist. If they're private-owned, we call that capitalist. And today, you don't have people talking about returning the value to the state, the value of the property, and letting the state. I know there was an interesting commercial on the Super Bowl where a producer and author, Larry David, was he was one of the creators of a 1990 show, Seinfeld. Uh-huh. He was on there and going through, acting like he was different places in history. And I thought it was really interesting because you look at the time where he was in the Middle Ages, and he was almost always the king telling someone that they couldn't do something that would have really helped productivity. And it was not until we changed our system to where the king or the queen didn't decide what was good and what was bad, that we started really creating a lot of the wealth that we enjoy today.
So this idea of socialism versus capitalism is certainly a big argument right now. But something that you've kind of mentioned is historical socialism isn't necessarily what we're seeing in some aspects today. I think, you know, you got to call fair shots when you see them. And I think that some people in the conservative side of the argument like to call things socialism that aren't socialism. So if you could define what aspects of our current economic situation we see that are tending towards socialism and how you see those things not just taking over but continuing down the capitalist structure like you mentioned.
I would say that in a natural sense, the economy tends in a socialist direction.
Okay.
Because people don't like risk, and they want to be taken care of. They want to avoid risk. I mean, we've seen it strong in the pandemic, where individuals just simply don't want to have to assume the risk that they may have to assume vis-a-vis the virus. With that said, individual policies as such have to be evaluated, and in my mind, to throw a dart at it and to call it socialist is probably too superficial and not very helpful. Because you really need to address what's going on with each individual policy prescription or, you know, just simply what's on the table. So, I mean, you can look at the minimum wage. I don't like the idea of a minimum wage. I think it's a very bad way to go about meeting a particular end. Now, is it socialist if we have a minimum wage? And, you know, in a vacuum by itself, the answer is no. But in a cultural setting where a minimum wage is part of the overall what you're doing, if you're chipping away in the direction of a lack of individual autonomy and freedom and control, then you're moving in the direction of socialism. So, you know, could we have a national minimum wage and not be socialist? And the answer is, of course, we could. A national minimum wage is a mistake, but we could do it, and the sun would come up tomorrow morning, and we would not be impoverished. I mean, it would change the distribution of wealth that we have to some extent, probably not to a large extent. It's a lot of political hype, you know, probably more than anything. But it in of itself is not socialist, but it is part of this natural human drift. Because we are risk averse and don't like bad stuff happening to us.
Yeah. You talked about avoiding risk, but also wanting to achieve productivity. And you kind of talked about, I mean, we talked about the market, you know, it's a competition of ideas to see which ideas become the, you know, most productive. How can we foster a system that allows for productivity, but also allows for people to feel secure? Is that possible? Because I feel like if most people thought that was possible, they could get on board with that. But what are some flaws with that argument, or what are the good things about that argument?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think we need to always keep in mind is that the people that are on the other side of the aisle from us politically have good motivation and are not bad folk, by and large. Yeah. I mean, there are bad folks on either side and people with bad motivation. But in general, when you're talking about economic ends, very few people want a bad result. Yeah. We want more, and we want it to be more equitably distributed. Those of us that favor a more free market would like to see equitable distribution of the wealth that's created. I believe that a economic regime that favors individual freedom largely is in favor of free trade. between individual nations. Sees very low tariffs, very small amount of intervention. I think that we should also have as much as possible free movement of individual people between nations, which is better, freer, legal immigration. So if you believe in some of these sort of factors, I think you ought to be arguing for them. And if you believe in something else, then you ought to, respectfully argue in that stand, from that standpoint also.
Yeah, I think the question I was getting at, and maybe mm-hmm. this is just too broad of an issue to express, but socialism as an idea, and we could spend an entire episode talking about that, and capitalism as an idea, which we could spend hours talking about, are in conflict, on suppositions of how an economy works. So is there like a middle ground that people might be able to find, or is it really kind of you choose one or you choose the other?
Well, in practice, we'll always hit the middle ground.
Okay.
I mean, that's where we are. We've never had a free market economy, and we never will. It is as utopian and Panglossian as the the idea of a socialist kind of a market.
Okay.
So we'll always be in the middle. But again, I still don't think that there is no really an articulated middle system. You're trending one direction or another.
Okay.
Your policies are socialist inclined or they're capitalist inclined.
Yeah.
One of the big factors that I would say is who's making the choices, who's making the decisions. If the decision making is being pushed up the food chain to individuals in charge, by and large, on its face, that's bad.
Yeah.
And needs to be overcome. If the decisions are being pushed down to a more decentralized plane, then then that is good. And it's just a simple reality of this, is that for making any decision, the individual person that is closer to that decision and is more involved has better information about making a good choice. And that's why you want free decisions in business.
Yeah.
And the more you push it up the chain and let Justin Trudeau or whoever make the choice for you, not that there's bad motive there, not that he's not a very intelligent, and not that our senators are not good and intelligent individuals with good motives. It's just simply they don't have the on-ground information to make a good choice. They make it in theory.
Yep.
They make it like a professor would make a choice.
Yeah.
Where you really need the people who are most accountable, most responsible. But also, there's this kind of knowledge that only happens at the time that the decision has to be made, and you just can't make those kind of choices from afar.
Yeah.
And that's why we should, largely be in favor of economic freedom.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to get at. So thanks for answering that question so clearly. You've mentioned the kind of the social gospel. I think oftentimes people will look at Jesus' ministry in some of the gospels and say the way he interacts with the population tends towards, a socialist interpretation of economic interaction. If you could address, you've already addressed, throughout this episode, kind of what the Bible has to say about how we treat people through economics. But if you could kind of, provide a biblical analysis of, economic interaction and maybe which argument that the Bible would lend evidence to support.
My recommendation for each individual is for you to be willing to give up and depart with all the wealth that you have, to give it to another person if you believe that the Lord would have you to do so. That you yourself be conformed into Christ's image and thereby reflect the kind of decisions. I mean, ultimately, what we would like is that we would make the same choices that Jesus would make if he were alive in 2022 in Cedarville, Ohio.
Yeah.
And so the individual person, should be willing to get his or her hands dirty. And you have to have individual ministry, and you do it as an individual. I also would say that what we have discovered is that what we've talked about here today, that individual freedom in a societal sense and how we organize our culture and our economy, should be something that's worth supporting also. Mm. So we know that what a free market culture does, and really we talk about this as economics, but I mean this is literally who we are, how we organize and react with each other. It's more than just the, you know, in fact, the more important things in life we don't buy or sell, you know, so it's not really, we're talking about how do you look at other individuals. You know, do I respect that person enough to allow them to make the, you know, the choices that they believe are best for them? Now, I think that also is part of where we live today. And sometimes Christians, you know that we have the revelation of God given to us in Scripture. So we sometimes want to impose that upon other individuals. And I would simply argue that what we really need to do is convince other individuals that they need to voluntarily kind of see the light and see, you know, see where we are. So that's what I would say. Again, I don't know. Sometimes I think that the way that we articulate the discussion between capitalism and socialism may not be as helpful as it was 75 years ago.
Yeah. You know? I think it's fair to say, as you've mentioned, that we live in a Genesis 3 world, and neither system is perfect. And it's helpful to hold to convictions, and convictions that you believe will lead to human flourishing, but the ultimate human flourishing won't occur until Jesus comes again. So it's helpful to keep that in mind. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a spectacular conversation. We like to give our guests 60 seconds at the end of each episode to kind of wrap up, you know, give an opportunity to say something they didn't get the chance to say, or if they have a broader message they'd like to give. So you can go ahead as whatever comes to mind.
Well, really what I was thinking on concluding on was the thing that I just said, and that is that individually you need to be willing to serve, and this does not mean simply giving to missionaries. It doesn't, although I think that's important, it doesn't simply mean giving to your local church, but it means you need to be willing to get with other people in terms of ministry.
Yeah.
And then again, like I say, largely support individual dignity and rights in the culture overall. You know, I was thinking in terms of books I've read in recent years I found to be really helpful. And one came to mind. It's called Inventing the Individual. Larry Seidenhop, Inventing the Individual. And what Professor Seidenhop does in this book is he outlines specifically from the time of the Greco-Roman world onward into Western culture, the importance of the individual. Mm-hmm. And I think that you could, we talked a lot this in this discussion about capitalism and socialism. I think a really good way to frame that argument is individualism and collectivism. What this book helps us to understand a little bit more about the individual person. So I would really recommend that book for your voracious readers and listeners to the podcast.
Well, we will make sure to put the link to that book in the description for our listeners so they can check that out. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for coming on today. We really appreciate it.
Certainly, Johnny. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Cedar 60 Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on social media and all major podcast platforms, and we hope that you'll join us next time as we continue to explore politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel. Thanks so much.